Americans love to discuss who or what is the greatest. You listen to most television or radio advertisements and you'll hear that some product is the highest ranked in its class, or it's the top seller, or 4 out of 5 experts recommend this product. Sports fans love to argue about the greatest athlete, the greatest team, or the greatest game of all time. A couple of years ago, I was given a book. Somebody knew my fascination with American presidents, and this book was written by historians ranking presidents in order of their greatness or their effectiveness. Now, it's always fascinating in one of these kinds of arguments or discussions when you turn up an unexpected name. In that particular book, you would expect some of the names at the top: Abraham Lincoln, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson. But there, right in the top 5, was the name James K. Polk, to which most people say, "Who?" And this is sometimes true in the spiritual realm as well. Once the eminent theologian Karl Barth was asked, "What is the most profound theological statement ever expressed?" Now, in his day, back in the 1950s, Karl Barth was just considered one of the deepest, most intelligent minds around in the theological field. And without much of a thought, he replied, "Jesus loves me. This I know, for the Bible tells me so." I'm sure that wasn't what the questioner expected to hear, but there's a lot of truth to his statement. Now, I bring this up this morning because in our series of messages, Hope Beyond the Headlines, we come to one of those verses that would have to rank very high on any list as the most significant verse in all the Bible. And yet it appears in a little obscure book that a lot of Christians can't even pronounce, let alone have ever read. And that's the book of Habakkuk. Warren Wiersbe writes, "We cannot overestimate or overstate the importance of this one verse. If you were to ask me what one of the most important verses of the Old Testament is, I would say Habakkuk 2:4. This verse is so important that it is quoted and explained in 3 different books of the New Testament. Old Testament scholar Walter Kaiser points out, so central to the whole Jewish thought was Habakkuk 2:4 that in the Talmud it records this famous remark given by Rabbi Simle. "Moses gave to Israel 613 commandments. In Psalm 15, David reduced them to 11. Micah 6:8 reduces them to 3. Habakkuk 2:4 to 1. One verse, one command. In fact, in the Hebrew text, it's only 3 words. And yet, it fairly summarizes the message of the whole Bible. Another writer remarks, "The key to the book of Habakkuk is the central theme of all the scriptures." Now, why would these men come to this conclusion? Well, as we've seen in our previous studies, Habakkuk wrestled with questions that have plagued mankind since the dawn of time. And they still echo to our present day. Why, God? Why do you allow such horrible things to happen on earth? Why do innocent people suffer? How can you use evil people and evil means to accomplish a holy will? Now, God's response to Habakkuk gives us the theme to this book. It's His promise of ultimate answers. And furthermore, the revelation given to the prophet is vital because it deals with the eternal destiny of everyone who's ever lived. It wasn't just for his own day. It wasn't just for a specific situation. He deals with the ultimate question of where will man go after this life is over. I'd like you to turn to this passage. It's the one that was read earlier, Habakkuk chapter 2. We're going to focus on verses 2 through 4. Last week we looked at verse 1, where Habakkuk says, "I am going to wait for the answer of God. I have spoken my mind. I've poured out my heart to God. Now I'm going to wait. I'm going to allow God to answer me. We're not sure how long he had to wait, but we do know that God did give him an answer to the questions that he had. So beginning in verse 2, then the Lord replied, write down the revelation. Make it plain on tablets so that a herald may run with it. For the revelation awaits an appointed time. It speaks of the end, and it will not prove false. Though it linger, wait for it. It will certainly come and will not delay. See, he is puffed up. His desires are not upright, but the righteous will live by his faith. Now in these verses, the Lord begins by giving Habakkuk a task. He says, in effect, now that you've stopped talking, start writing. Now that you've said your piece, listen to what I have to say, but I want you to write it down. Because the answer is not just for you, Habakkuk. And I want you to write it plain, put it on tablets, so that a herald can run with it. Now that phrase is a little obscure in the Hebrew. They're not sure if it means that a person running by would be able to read it, or that the person who reads it would be able to run and tell others. Most scholars think it's the second, but it could be either one. The idea was Habakkuk was to write this revelation on great big tablets. He wasn't talking about a little scrap of paper. He wasn't saying, Habakkuk, grab a post-it note because I'm going to tell you something I want you to write down. He was to write it on these big tablets, and these tablets would be posted in a public place. I think the best illustration today, it would be as though today, if Habakkuk lived today and God were to come, he'd say, Habakkuk, I want you to put this on a billboard so that everybody that drives by can see it and read it. Now, you can't put a whole lot on a billboard that people are going to see. You can't put it in a real fine print because they won't be able to read it all. It's going to be simple. It has to be something in a nutshell, so that the people who go by will see it and then they can take it and spread it to others. They can take the word to others. So what is this short message? What is this phrase that God says? Very simply this, the righteous shall live by his faith. Simple enough to put on a billboard. Like I said, in the Hebrew, it was only three words. He could have put those three words in great big letters and stuck it on the public square so that everybody that goes by can see it. The just shall live by his faith. It was to be clear. It was to be understandable. It was to be something people could put into practice. And how we need this today. Often those who communicate God's revelation to the world are rightly accused of confusing their listeners with theological jargon and complicated schemes and stuff that you need to be a rocket surgeon to understand. Glad somebody got that. So the Lord never intended his message to be baffling or confusing. He meant it to be simple and easy to understand, and something we could put it into practice, something that's applicable. Otherwise, we're wasting our time. Now, I would say that if Habakkuk did not follow God's command, we would not be studying this today. Habakkuk was obedient. He wrote it down. He wrote down God's answer. And it was to be done in such a way that it would not only affect his generation, but it was a permanent revelation that age after age can hear it, can live it, and it can affect their lives. Now, as we consider the answer that God gives, I'd first like to focus on the context of the answer. Verse 3 states, the revelation awaits an appointed time. It speaks of the end, and it will not prove false. Right from the beginning, God is telling Habakkuk, this answer I'm giving to you, it's not just for your day and age. We are talking about the ultimate answer. to the ultimate question, not just simply a specific answer to a specific question. The revelation God gave was for a future time and a future place. It speaks of the end. Now, in the immediate context, he's talking about the Babylonian captivity, which was about to come on Judah. The Babylonians were going to come in. They were going to destroy Jerusalem. They were going to tear down the temple. There wasn't going to be anything left. And many of the Jews were going to be taken hundreds of miles away to Babylon for 70 years. They would be exiles in another nation before the Jews would be allowed to return to their homeland. And the message to those folks was, you hold on to your faith. You keep trusting in God through those difficult days and you'll come out on the other side. Now that's the immediate context of what Habakkuk was saying. But when we go to the New Testament, we find a more ultimate context. Led by the Holy Spirit, the writer of the book of Hebrews takes this very verse, but he alters it just a little bit. He changes the word it to the word he. In Hebrews 10:37, we read, he who is coming will come and will not delay. Who's the he? Jesus Christ. Jesus is coming. And that is the end. We are looking forward to the end of time when Jesus comes, the culmination of history. And when Jesus comes, he'll set everything straight. He'll right every wrong. He will judge every man according to his deeds. Everything will be put right. He is the ultimate answer. And the author of Hebrews says, he will come and he will not delay. So we're speaking here of, again, going beyond Habakkuk's own day and time. Looking at the big picture, we're talking about the ultimate answer to man's ultimate question. And how will that affect our lives? Now, we might be confused by the remainder of verse 3. It says, though it linger, wait for it, it will certainly come and will not delay. That seems a little confusing, doesn't it? God is telling Habakkuk, you may have to wait for it, but it won't be delayed. Wait a minute, if we wait for it, but it's not being delayed, why would we wait? What is he talking about here? The solution is found in God's timing, which is very different than our own. Isaiah tells us that as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are God's thoughts higher than our thoughts, and God's ways than our ways. He just runs on a whole different schedule. He has a whole different plan than anything we can imagine. And God's timetable is very different than ours because he is eternal. Now, we often speak of eternity as a really long time. It never has a beginning and it never has an end. And that's true, but there's more to it than that. Being eternal means that you aren't bound by time. And God is above time. See, to God, there's no past. To God, there is no future. Everything is right now. He sees the whole history and destiny of man all at once. It's all laid out before him. We are the ones who are bound by time. We are the ones who have past, present, and future. And we don't see the future. We don't know exactly what's coming next. But to God, it's all laid out in front of him. So to him, there is no being late. There's no being early, because to God it's all in the present. A good commentary on this verse is found in 2 Peter chapter 3. 2 Peter chapter 3, which again is speaking of the end. Speaking of the end times, we often call it. 2 Peter chapter 3, I want to read verses 3 and 4 and then jump down to verses 8 through 10. First of all, you must understand that in the last days scoffers will come, scoffing and following their own evil desires. They will say, where is this coming that he promised? People are going to come around and say, God made these promises that Jesus is going to come. Hasn't happened yet. Been 2,000 years. Why do we think it's going to come at all? It hasn't happened yet. Now jump down to verse 8. But do not forget this one thing, dear friends. To the Lord, a day is like 1,000 years. And 1,000 years are like a day. The Lord is not slow in keeping His promise, as some understand slowness. He is patient with you, not wanting anyone to perish, but everyone to come to repentance. See, this is why there's this waiting. Because God's patient. He wants everybody to have the opportunity to come to Him. But notice the beginning of verse 10. But the day of the Lord will come. There is a certainty. There is an absolute certainty. It will come. It just may not come in our timetable. You see the contrast here? Mankind sees God as moving slowly, doubting that He'll ever follow through on His promises. But God moves according to His plan. And in His plan, days and thousands of years don't really mean anything. It's His plan. When I was in high school, a Christian band recorded a song that was entitled Perfect Timing. The chorus stated, speaking toward God, "You've got perfect timing. You're not a minute too soon, not a moment too late. You've got perfect timing. I can see when you move. I can feel when you wait. You hold tomorrow in the palm of your hand. Everything moves by your master plan. You've got perfect timing." That's what God's telling Habakkuk. This is on my time plan. This is on my scale. You've got to trust me. I like the way the Living Bible paraphrases this verse. Things I plan won't happen right away. Slowly, steadily, surely, the time approaches when the vision will be fulfilled. If it seems slow, do not despair, for these things will surely come to pass. Just be patient. They will not be overdue a single day. See, we shouldn't get discouraged. A delay is not a denial from God. We must allow Him to be God and to trust that His timing is always perfect. Now, secondly, I want to consider the certainty of the answer. We kind of mentioned it before. Verse 3 says it will come and it will not delay. God is saying, Habakkuk, the answer is coming. You may not see it right away, but it is coming. So be patient. Wait for it. And this is true of all biblical prophecy. The promises of God may tarry, they may delay, but nothing can prevent them from happening. Nothing can frustrate their fulfillment. What God has promised, He will certainly perform. And there's a tone of complete finality in all Bible prophecy. There's no if. There's no maybe or perhaps. It's going to happen. God stakes His very reputation. He says, according to my name, I promise you these things. It's going to take place. It just may not happen on your plan. It may not happen according to your schedule. We've been noticing this in our Sunday school class. We're going through the book of Acts and seeing the life of Paul. And Paul was a man of action. He was ready to go. And we saw this morning how he had written to the Roman church and said, you know, I plan on visiting you. I'd love to come and see you on my way to Spain. And when I get done with this collection back to Jerusalem, I want to come your way. I want to stay with you for a little while. And then I'm on my way to Spain to my next missionary journey. It didn't quite happen that way. When he got to Jerusalem, he got arrested for a false charge. He was set in a prison cell in Caesarea for 2 years, went to Rome and had to sit another 2 years to await trial. Now, the Bible isn't very clear about it, but from what we know of history, it does appear Paul did eventually make that trip to Spain. We know he made the trip to Rome. It just wasn't the way he planned. He didn't plan to go there as a prisoner and in chains. And he certainly didn't plan on having to wait 4 years for this to all happen. But it happened. And how many times in our lives can we see this thing? My brother and sister-in-law, Bob and Carol, that are ministering in Germany. Bob was called as a missionary to Germany when he was in junior high school. And he was sure that that's what God wanted him to do. And he went to Bible college and prepared for that. But circumstances just didn't work out. The doors didn't open at that time. In fact, they didn't open for 30 years. And then, unexpectedly, a door opened. And now he's a missionary to Germany, which God had called him to all those years before. It came about, just not quite the way he had planned. And that's true in all of our lives. God is at work, and he will bring it about. It just may not be quite the way or the timing that we think. So as we read the newspapers, as we watch the evening news, we might be tempted to be discouraged. You know, we might wonder, like Habakkuk did, if God really cared. God, are you even there? Then as we see other events unfold, we're thinking, God, are you unfair? This doesn't make sense. And we might slip into doubt and despair. But the good news for us this morning is that there is hope beyond the headlines. We can trust God in the face of events that seem to be so muddled and unclear. Somebody once asked Billy Graham how he could be so optimistic in the face of war, injustice, uncertainty. And he said, I'm optimistic because I've read the end of the book. I know how it ends. I know that in the end, God triumphs. And that can be the basis of our faith. God wins. You know, of all people on earth, Christians ought to be the most optimistic because we know how the story ends. We know that in the end, Christ will triumph and all those with him will share in that victory. We know it's going to happen. But you know what we're like more often than not? We're like a situation that happened in my life. I was a teenager watching the 1980 Winter Olympics. And the USA hockey team was playing the Russians. And of course, the Russians, they were a juggernaut. I mean, those guys had been playing hockey for years. They were more like pros, and we had these college kids going up against them. They had beaten the United States 10 to nothing right before the Olympics in an exhibition game. And you don't score 10 goals in a hockey game very often. We're watching that game, and there were several friends of mine with us, and we're watching that game, and we're on the edge of our seats. And as the minutes clicked down, and the Americans had a one-goal lead, and boy, the Russians, they were just coming wave after wave, and shots were banging off of the posts, and it was just like, oh! You know what the crazy thing was? We already knew the final score. The game had been played much earlier in the day and it was on tape delay. We knew that the United States had won, but we're on the edge of our seats. Oh, what's going to happen? It's like watching a rerun and wondering if it's going to come out different this time. We know the end of the story. We know how it's going to end. And yet we're like, oh God, is this really going to happen? God said, yes. You know what? In God's view, it has already happened. Because God is above time. There's no future with God. It's already done. When Jesus cried out on the cross, it is finished. It's done. We don't need to be afraid. We don't need to be uncertain. God said, it is finished. It is done. Now, I know that you know, watching that hockey game might be a silly illustration, but the principle's the same. When we trust God, we know how it turns out. And that is why God told Habakkuk, the righteous will live by faith. The righteous will survive by their faith. And once again, I would suggest it's not how strong your faith is, it's how strong the object of your faith is. I've often used the illustration of faith as sitting on a chair because you're resting all of your weight into it and hoping it holds you up. Now, if you have a really, really rickety chair that probably wouldn't hold a fly if it landed on it, you can have all the faith in the world and plop yourself in that chair. If that chair ain't going to hold you up, no amount of faith is going to keep you from hitting the floor. Because that chair was not trustworthy. But if the chair is going to hold you up and you're not really sure if it's going to, it'll still hold you up, regardless of how much you believe in it or not. You see the connection? Our faith will last, not because of how strong our faith is or how great our faith is. It's on how great our God is. And that's why we can be sure. That's the certainty of the answer. In God's purview, it's already happened. It's finished. It's done. We're just time-bound and have to wait for it all to come to pass. And so we get to the real content of God's answer. It's found in verse 4. And he says it as a contrast. See, he is puffed up. His desires are not upright, but the righteous will live by faith. He's contrasting two different kinds of people. Those who arrogantly trust themselves and leave God out of their lives against people of faith. The first group, they're self-centered, and therefore they're doomed. The second group is God-centered, and they will survive. Now again, the immediate application of this was to the Babylonians, but the principle echoes down through the ages. Jesus spoke of two crowds that are on two roads heading to two destinations. In Matthew 7, 13 and 14, he says, "Enter through the narrow gate. For wide is the gate and broad is the road that leads to destruction, and many there be that enter it. But small is the gate, narrow is the road that leads to life, and only a few find it." You see, Habakkuk was initially concerned about how the wicked seemed to be getting away with everything and the righteous were becoming extinct, both within his own borders of Judah and then beyond that to the Babylonians. But God tells him, look, Habakkuk, I can tell the difference between the two. I can tell the righteous from the unrighteous. I have the insight. I can tell them apart. And it may appear that the wicked are getting away with it. And it may appear that the righteous are on their way out, but I know better. In the end, all will be put right and just. Now, how can we comprehend that? When everything we see and everything we hear and everything we feel points in the opposite direction. And that last phrase tells it all. By faith. That's where our faith comes in. God has designed us to live by faith in what He said will happen, not by circumstances, not by our observations or our own human reasoning. Paul writes in 2 Corinthians 5:7, "We walk by faith, not by sight." I like how Wiersbe explains that phrase. To walk by faith means to look at earth from heaven's point of view. To walk by sight is to look at heaven from earth's point of view. You see the difference? Walking by faith means we take God's perspective. We look at earth from heaven's point of view. We take what God says in His Word and we trust that. Walking by sight means we're looking at heaven from earth's point of view saying, God, what are you doing? Are you doing anything? That's where Habakkuk started. He began walking by sight. He looked around and said, where are you, God? What are you doing? God says, you need to walk by faith. You need to look through my eyes. You need to look at things through my perspective. That's what it means to walk by faith. It's to gain his eternal perspective. Walking by sight maintains our own time-bound perception. And those who insist on looking at heaven from earth's point of view, they're going to live confused, frustrated lives. But those who can look at earth from God's point of view will learn to live in peace. They may not have all of the answers. They may not understand everything that happens. But through their faith in God, they can trust that He knows all, He sees all, and works everything according to His plan. You know, the just shall live by faith was the watchword of the Protestant Reformation. They may be the most seven important words in all church history, because it was this verse, as quoted in Romans, that Martin Luther grasped onto and said, you know what? Everything that's being taught in my day and age is wrong. The just will live by faith. And it was through that that the whole Protestant Reformation was started, from this verse. This little verse in that obscure book of Habakkuk. Luther said, this text was to me the true gate of paradise. It all made sense through that one verse. Now, one question that scholars still debate about this verse is the word faith. Does it mean faith or does it mean faithfulness? Is a person justified or saved by what they believe or by how faithful they act? But when you dig into the scriptures, you find that there's really not much of a debate. In both the Hebrew and the Greek languages, faith and faithfulness come from the same word. You cannot have one without the other. When we have faith, we will be faithful. God says that's what it takes to survive. If I have faith in a faithful God, others will know it by the way I live, because I will be faithful to Him. For faith to be real, there needs to be a faithfulness about what that faith claims to believe. Now, Stuart Briscoe writes, one of the tragedies of the Church of Jesus Christ in the Western world today is that we have made it so easy to believe that we have put a great divide between coming to faith and living faithful lives. Accordingly, it's not uncommon to find people who make loud protests of faith in Jesus Christ, nevertheless they live in direct disobedience to Christ. Listen to what Habakkuk says about this. Those who are not living by faith and showing it in their faithful lives come under the judgment of God. On the other hand, those who in the midst of judgment are living by faith in Him and showing it by their faithful lives, they will be preserved. That's what he's saying here. We come to God by faith. We live by faith. We are faithful to Him. And God revealed to Habakkuk, all mankind are separated into two groups. You have the faithful and the unfaithful. We're saved by faith. We live by faith. Faith is a lifestyle, and it's the exact opposite of being puffed up, because that's all about self. Faith is relying on God. Now, you know, oftentimes, the enemy of our faith is our feelings. Because emotions are so self-oriented and so dependent upon what we see and hear and feel, we tend not to trust what we can't see and understand with our feelings. When we react emotionally to the world around us, we usually end up either afraid or angry, or maybe a little bit of both. But God says to His prophet, and He says to us, if you live by feelings, you'll be continually curled up in a corner, quaking with fear. But if you live by faith, you listen to me, you trust me, you live by faith. Those are your marching orders. Don't live by feelings. Live by faith. Take what I have told you in my word and hang on to it and live it. And you will see it come to pass. Now, I want you to notice that God did not answer Habakkuk's question, why or how long or how could you? And those aren't the kinds of questions God usually answers. But when we have significant questions, God provides the ultimate answer. And you know what that answer is? I am. The answer to life's questions is God. He is the ultimate answer. Faith is not always knowing what's going to happen tomorrow. Faith is knowing who holds tomorrow. Faith is relying on Him. And when we trust Him, who cares what happens, right? Paul said in Romans, if God be for us, who can be against us? I like to paraphrase that. If God be for us, who cares who's against us? Because we will win. The final score has already been set. We're just watching it play out on time delay. The ultimate answer to life is to trust God. Because the just shall live by faith. That's all it takes.